This is the takeaway for Thursday, January 5th, 2017.
Director Clapper, how would you describe your confidence in attributing these attacks to the Russian government as opposed to someone in your basement?
It's very high.
Welcome to this Cold War special edition of The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thank you so much for listening. That's James Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence, answering the $64 million or $64 billion question from Indiana Democrat Senator Joe Donnelly. Today, the Senate is holding its first hearing on Russian interference in the U.S. election, something the Obama administration has said happened not with very high probability or confidence, but with 100% certainty. While Julian Assange of WikiLeaks is equally sure, that's not how it went.
Did Russia give you this information or anybody associated with Russia?
Our source is not a state party. So the answer for our interactions is no.
He sounds a little like a senator there, but that's talk show host Sean Hannity on Fox questioning WikiLeaks' Julian Assange this week about the leaks from the Democratic National Committee last summer. And this is the line of President-elect Trump, the idea that the leaks aren't directly connected with Russia. So in all this, there's an intense confusion. And maybe the handful of congressional hearings expected in upcoming weeks can help to clarify it. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, is watching the hearings for us. Todd, welcome. Are things clarifying or is it polarization here?
People want them to be clarified a little bit more because next week, John, is the week that the intelligence community, specifically the CIA, the NSA, and the FBI, are set to deliver their report on Russian hacking of the election. There was a hope that it might come out this week. James Clapper, the DNI director, said it'll come out next week. Reportedly, the president gets the report today. There will be a classified version of that report and, of course, an unclassified version of that report. But already back on October 7th, as everyone is familiar, the intelligence community unanimously, John, 17 agencies did conclude that Russia was responsible, that they intended to sway the election, and that approval went to the very highest levels of the Russian government, read Vladimir Putin. So here was James Clapper in front of the Senate Armed Services Committee and John McCain as chairman today giving his assessment not only of the hacking but of broader Russian interference.
This was a multifaceted campaign. So the hacking was only one part of it, and it also entailed classical propaganda, disinformation, fake news.
This is John McCain's. I mean, this is something he is, like, very clearly interested in, I mean, to get to the bottom of this. How is his tone? How is he running this hearing?
You've seen McCain aggressive, and he's been aggressive all along. He's called Russian hacking in the election an act of war. Not very surprising from John McCain, because John McCain has classified himself as a Russia hawk and a defense hawk, a very aggressive stance towards Russia, in contrast with a shifting tone among many Republicans, frankly, John, having won this election, Donald Trump having won this election, who seem to have backed off their criticism of Russia ever since that election. You've heard a lot of former critics of Russia kind of go silent. And the cut you played of Julian Assange, the president-elect in his tweets taking the side of Julian Assange and his assessment that it wasn't the Russians who were behind, that it could have been anybody in their basement. You don't know who hacks. Donald Trump says computers are complicated. You don't know who did the hacking. You heard in Assange's language there saying that their source wasn't a Russian state actor. He didn't say there wasn't an intermediary or somebody connected to the state. He said it wasn't the Russian state. So that leaves him an awful lot of running room as far as Julian Assange is concerned. Here's John McCain asking Clapper what he thinks.
General Clapper, I just have to mention the name Mr. Assange has popped up, and I believe that he is the one who's responsible for publishing names of individuals that work for us that put their lives in direct danger. Is that correct?
Yes, he has.
And do you think that there's any credibility we should attach to this individual, given his record of...
Not in my view.
Not in your view.
dripping with contempt, McCain there talking about Assange. And it seems that Clapper implicitly here is suggesting that, you know, Assange allowed himself to be a front for the Russians. That's how they're interpreting it.
Yeah, I think that that's true. I don't think any of these people testifying in front of the committee have also forgotten that Julian Assange assisted the escape and spiriting of Edward Snowden into Russia. That's all in the front of their minds, too, and certainly in the front of John McCain's mind, somebody who's, you know, Edward Snowden, somebody who's viewed very differently by a lot of people on Capitol Hill and members of the public than Julian Assange is. But, you know, there is pushback also from some other Republicans on the idea, not necessarily that the Russians might have been responsible, but that Donald Trump himself is somehow pro-Russia. You know, John, there was a lot of there have been a lot of upset lawmakers as Donald Trump has taken to Twitter to not only question, but in some ways undermine the intelligence community, not only their accuracy, but he said that the intelligence community is out to get him. Not everybody. Tom Cotton is a former member of the military. He's from Arkansas, and he's on this committee. He went to some length to show that Donald Trump's actions, forget about his words, aren't pro-Russia at all.
Donald Trump has proposed to increase our defense budget, to accelerate nuclear modernization, to accelerate ballistic missile defenses, and to expand and accelerate oil and gas production, which would obviously harm Russia's economy. Hillary Clinton opposed, or at least was not as enthusiastic about all those measures. Would each of those put the United States in a stronger strategic position against Russia?
Certainly, anything we do to enhance our military capabilities, absolutely.
I don't know if that constitutes an actual answer there. I mean, one of the things that you've reported on, which I think is absolutely crucial here, is that within the GOP, there is a division over whether we want to get chummy and, you know, old-style detente with the Russians, or whether we want to stay on this very much military footing with Vladimir Putin. What do we know from these hearings?
No question. And you're seeing that playing out. Look, part of the backdrop of this also, John, takes place away from the Armed Services Committee. Rex Tillerson, the former CEO of Exxon, who's the nominee to be Secretary of State, has been taking meetings all over Capitol Hill, which is the custom, prior to his confirmation hearings next week, because of the broader concerns about his own relationship with Russia in business and his personal relationships with Vladimir Putin. And in those meetings, Tillerson reportedly has been taking a hard line on Russia, trying to assure senators that he understands the Russian threat. Now, he is trying to prevent his nomination from taking on a broader spectrum of concerns about Russia so that he doesn't get tanked over Republican senators like McCain, Lindsey Graham, and others who want to brush back this idea of warming to the Russians. John, one of the themes of this hearing beyond Russia was growing cyber threats from lots of countries, countries that may have asymmetrical security relationships with the United States. Think North Korea or Iran. Sort of the ability for high gain, low risk interventions in the United States or cyber attacks. Lindsey Graham was one person warning that even if you can't pin Donald Trump's election on Russian interference, which he didn't try to do, of course, that Republicans should take this very seriously because next time it might be them.
Admiral Rogers, is this going to stop until we make the cost higher?
We have got to change the dynamic here because we're on the wrong end of the cost equation.
Yeah, you got that right. Could it be Republicans next election?
This is not about parties per se.
Yeah, it's not like we're so much better at cybersecurity than Democrats.
Right.
And John, here's Lindsey Graham telegraphing some tough new policies that are likely to come out of Congress soon for all of those people who want to hit back on cyber espionage and cyber attacks.
Would I be justified as a United States senator taking your information about Russia's involvement in our election and what they're doing throughout the world and be more aggressive than President Obama if I chose to?
That's your choice, Senator.
Do you think he was justified in imposing new sanctions based on what Russia did?
I do.
Okay. So to those of you who want to throw rocks, you're going to get a chance here soon. And if we don't throw rocks, we're going to make a huge mistake.
Wow, that's that states a position right there. That's territory. That's marching orders.
And it's not just Lindsey Graham's position, because as much as we've been talking about Obamacare and that stuff's important and tax cuts, in the background in the Senate, a new round of tough Russia sanctions are being written in the back committee rooms right now that will come to the floor in the next couple of weeks. You're going to see Congress try to take a real swipe at Russia. The question is, will the new president, Donald Trump, go along when they do it? Those are the rocks that Lindsey Graham's talking about.
Well, since you jogged my memory there, we do need to talk about Obamacare here. This is repeal week, or this or next week will be repeal week of Obamacare. What does it look like the repeal is going to mean, and is there any sense of where we go from here?
Well, Vice President-elect Mike Pence on the Hill yesterday talking to Republicans about what repeal looks like. Nobody knows quite yet. The process has started. It's going to take a little while. It'll take a couple of weeks, maybe a month. But repeal won't happen right away. There'll be a delay. One thing Republicans have said, John, is that 2017, they will come up with a plan. They don't know what that plan is yet, what it looks like, and how many people will be covered. But this gave people a lot of pause. Here's Presidential-elect Counselor Kellyanne Conway on Cable News. Just a day ago. Listen.
There's no question that there will be different health insurance coverage in this country under President Trump.
If Americans have health care today under the Affordable Care Act, will they have health care? It sounds like Donald Trump is saying they will have health care.
Yes, he is.
Under whatever replaces it.
That is correct. We don't want anyone who currently has insurance to not have insurance. Also, okay. We are very aware that the public likes coverage for pre-existing conditions. Mm-hmm. There are some pieces of merit in the current plan.
So they're trying to be reassuring. Are Republicans going along with it?
Except that's a policy statement. Nobody who has insurance now under Obamacare will go without insurance. I asked staffers and spokespeople for Paul Ryan whether that was his policy. I asked Mitch McConnell directly if he can support no one losing insurance under a replacement plan. Nobody would commit to that. In fact, they wouldn't even answer the question. That has never been Republican policy, to provide insurance to every one of the estimated 20 million people who've gained coverage under the ACA, whether it's exchanges or Medicaid. So they're going to spend the next year writing a plan, and Republicans on the Hill are not promising that thing to cover everyone. We'll have to see how many they do cover. Just one of the many questions they're going to have to answer, including the political questions, John, now that they own health care.
Well, get out there and make them answer the questions, Todd. Really take away Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.
You got it, John.
You really have to have a thick skin to live in the Twitter world, folks. Warning, is your skin thick enough for this heavy-duty bleepage?
You're getting gassed. Lindy West is a fat b. You f***ing obese cow. Fat people should be rounded up and shot.
This is the kind of thing feminist writer Lindy West has had to put up with for years, among many other issues. She writes about her weight. She's a self-declared fat woman, which I suppose means President-elect Donald Trump won't be tweeting at her. But this is the odd thing about Twitter. From presidents to popes to haters to out-and-out Nazis, Twitter is this American First Amendment free speech sanctuary that maybe isn't doing the First Amendment any favors these days. And it may be why several notable writers have announced that they are leaving Twitter. Sherman Alexie, Ta-Nehisi Coates, and Lindy West, who I mentioned above, have all tweeted for the last time, they say. It's a pattern, let's not call it a boycott, and they may all come back. Alexie says Twitter's negatives increasingly outweigh its positives. Coates thinks it's a distraction as he takes time to focus on writing a new book. For Lindy West, though, it goes beyond thick skin and trolls. In a piece for The Guardian, where she's a columnist, she says Twitter is becoming an internet home where neo-Nazis roam free.
It was more of a spontaneous impulse than a New Year's resolution. Although it does feel like a juice cleanse, a molting, a polar bear plunge, a clean slate. Except the opposite, like throwing your slate into a volcano and running. One moment I was brains deep in the usual way, half-heartedly arguing with strangers, and the next moment the US president-elect was using the self-same platform to taunt North Korea about the size of its nuclear program. And I realized, I'm done. I could be swimming right now, or flossing, or digging a big pointless pit. Anything else. Twitter, for the past 5 years, has been a machine where I put in unpaid work and tension headaches come out. I write jokes there for free. I post political commentary for free. I answer questions for free. I teach feminism 101 for free. Off Twitter, these are all things by which I make my living. In fact, they comprise the totality of my income. but on Twitter. I do them pro bono, and in return, I am micromanaged in real time by strangers. Neo-Nazis mine my personal life for vulnerabilities to exploit, and men enjoy unfettered direct access to my brain so they can inform me for the thousandth time that they would gladly rape me if I weren't so fat. I talk back and I am feeding the trolls. I say nothing and the harassment escalates. I report threats and I'm a censor. I use mass blocking tools to curb abuse, and I'm abused further for blocking unfairly. I have to conclude, after half a decade of troubleshooting, that it may simply be impossible to make this platform usable for anyone but trolls, robots, and dictators. Surprisingly, none of that is the reason I left. I still love Twitter. The speed of information, the breadth of analysis, the jokes, the gifs, the fortifying, albeit intermittent, solidarity. But I'm leaving anyway. For a while. I hate to disappoint anyone, but the breaking point for me wasn't the trolls themselves. If I've learned anything from the dark side of Twitter, it's how to feel nothing when a frog calls you the C-word. It was the global repercussions of Twitter's refusal to stop them. The white supremacist, anti-feminist, isolationist, transphobic, alt-right movement has been beta-testing its propaganda and intimidation machine on marginalized Twitter communities for years now, and discovered, to its leering delight, that the limit did not exist. No one cared. Twitter abuse was a grand-scale normalization project, disseminating libel and disinformation, muddying long-held cultural givens, such as racism is bad, and sexual assault is bad, and lying is bad, and authoritarianism is bad. And ultimately greasing the wheels for Donald Trump's ascendance to the U.S. presidency.
I'm picking up yesterday 100,000 people. I'm not saying I love it, but it does get the word out.
On December 29th, Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey tweeted, "What's the most important thing you want to see Twitter improve or create in 2017? One user responded, "Comprehensive plan for getting rid of the Nazis." "We've been working on our policies and controls," Dorsey replied. "What's the next most critical thing?" "Oh, what's our second highest priority after Nazis?" "I'd say number two is also Nazis. And number three. In fact, you can just go ahead and slide Nazis into the top 100 spots. Get back to me when your website isn't a roiling rat king of Nazis." Trump uses his Twitter account to set hate mobs on private citizens, attempt to silence journalists who write unfavorably about him, lie to the American people, and bulldoze complex diplomatic relationships with other world powers. I quit Twitter because it feels unconscionable to be a part of it, to generate revenue for it, to participate in its profoundly broken culture and lend my name to its legitimacy. Twitter's home to a wealth of fantastic anti-Trump organizing as well, but I'm personally weary of feeling hostage to a platform that has treated me and the people I care about so poorly. We can do good work elsewhere. I'm pretty sure ushered in kleptocracy would be a deal breaker for any other company that wanted my business. If I found out my favorite coffee shop was even remotely complicit in World War III, I would bare minimum switch coffee shops. I might give up coffee altogether. Apparently that sentiment is in the air, because as I was writing this column, I came across a post by my friend Lauren Hoffman, a writer for Vulture and Cosmopolitan. She said, "I've made many real good friends on Twitter, but I guess if I met all my friends working at, like, the mall, and the mall became a tacit endorsement of fascism, I would keep the friends, but stop going to the mall." Keep the friends. Ditch the mall.
That's Lindy West, feminist writer and columnist for The Guardian. She's also author of a new book called Shrill, a memoir that includes some colorful tales of her life on Twitter. We did reach out to Twitter for a comment on all this. If and when we hear back, we'll let you know. Maybe we'll even tweet it to you.
This is Lori from Plano. I think, no, they're not doing enough to police hate speech, and I don't think it's the role of social media to police. They could possibly get some better filters to help with that. So it's really hard to answer because some of that speech turns into actions. We don't want that. On the other hand, freedom of speech is a right.
Your calls on this all hour at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is supported by Enterprise Florida, working to promote Florida as a premier business destination for companies interested in relocation or expansion. More information at floridathefutureishere.com.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Donald Trump is hardly the first world leader to address his citizens via social media, even Twitter. One head of state has mobilized the internet to be his own personal militia. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte is allegedly on the cutting edge of using social media to flood Twitter, Facebook, and other platforms with attacks against his critics and to post positive spinning pro-Duterte propaganda at the same time. Journalist Sean Williams says he was on the receiving end of Duterte's keyboard commandos. His feature article entitled Duterte's Army of Online Trolls is in this month's New Republic. So when did you first understand that you were on the receiving end here?
Well, it was quite early on when I was reporting out there. I noticed that I was picking up a bit of an online tail. There was a few people who were kind of following me online. And then through speaking to other people who are involved in human rights and journalism there, I learned that it was far from an original thing. And this is pretty much standard going for everyone covering the drug war and anything else in the Philippines right now.
How much do you think the effectiveness of this is a result of the youth of the Philippine population?
Huge, huge, huge. Yes. The Philippines is an incredibly young nation. I think I'd researched in the article, I think it's around 23 years is the average age out there. And as importantly is the way that mobile networks and the internet are being used out there as well. So for instance, a huge, huge part of all of this is that people get Facebook free with their phones, but they can't actually click through to anything. So because they would incur data charges. So people just keep scrolling through and scrolling through Facebook, looking at these kind of incendiary headlines by partisan websites, but they don't actually click through to any meat. So they just kind of consume this daily diet of highly inflammatory, one-sided information. And I think that's where a lot of this comes from.
A one-sided, interactive social media milieu is what you're describing here, which is one of the things that's very interesting here. One of the other things is this feels a little bit like a monster that they can't get back in the box. I mean, there's a lot out there that is actually no humans at all.
Yeah, yeah. And some of the stuff that I'd researched was that some of the people who are paid to do this kind of stuff, they'll just create a lot of fake accounts on social media. And really, because the government is the entity that has the clout to do that, it's really hard for any opposing voices to get their voices heard, really. So what I was kind of putting across in the article as well was that social media platforms like Facebook, like Twitter, have been co-opted by the bigger players now, where once they were seen as the voice of the masses, they're kind of being used by the people with the most money and the bigger means to get that message across. And that's kind of a worrying development.
And 20% of the Duterte mentions just come from bots?
Yeah, I looked into it alongside a social media research company, and they were surprised, and so was I, that this amount of noise just being put out by fake accounts is so strong around Duterte. So that kind of says a lot about where his messages are coming from. His following is not an illusion. It is there. People do kind of admire him. But, it's being very much propped up by a lot of this noise online.
Journalist Sean Williams is the author of Duterte's Army of Online Trolls in this month's New Republic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The words investment banker and Bangladesh rarely share the same sentence, but they are on the resume of Doreen Shanaz.
Defiant optimism. As a Bangladeshi woman, I led a lifetime defining those words. The reason why? I am creating the world's first social stock exchange, and this will revolutionize the way we look at development in Asia and hopefully the rest of the world.
Doreen launched the Impact Investment Exchange in 2013 in a TED Talk. The social stock exchange is going strong today, connecting capital with projects in Cambodia, Bangladesh, and the Philippines, from diesel to biofuel and vocational programs. 12 million people throughout Asia have reportedly benefited. Doreen Shahnaz lives in Singapore, was a recipient of last year's Asia Society's Game Changer Award, and is the first Bangladeshi woman to graduate from the Wharton School of Business and go to work directly on Wall Street.
So the way it usually works is, you know, we initially spent a lot of time trying to find these entities, right, who are out there doing this great work but could be financially viable. And now I guess we are at a stage they come to us because we have had, you know, a lot of success in terms of working with them. So usually an entrepreneur will come and say, hey, you know, we have this low-cost school which is working with the poor. I'm charging very little. And is there any way I can go to the next stage? So what we do is we spend quite a bit of time getting them what we call sort of investment ready. We also work with them in terms of calculating the social impact that they're creating. So the whole financial and the social, I would say, calculations go hand in hand. And then we basically put it up in front of our investors. And I think what has been nice for us to see the fact that on the investor side, people tend to invest where they're from, right? So once they do one of them, then they say, oh, this is actually sort of interesting. So then they look at a different sector or different country. So we are actually in the process also changing the behavior of investors, which is great.
Let's talk about a project that sure. has actually returned yeah. on equity, mm-hmm. that someone can go, yes, I improve things, and I also have an investment that's worth more today than it was when I invested.
There is an entity that we helped get to the next stage in Cambodia where he was bringing the entrepreneur off-grid electricity to the rural poor. It was about 60,000 households. So we, you know, we worked in a very early stage, which was taking an independent power plant, turn it from diesel into biofuel, and then working with him and taking it to the off-grid. And that one, actually, he returned about 25%. IRR, which is, you know, incredible. Again,
maybe the 25% should go to the people of Cambodia who are poor. The capitalist model rewarding the investor is fine, but right. isn't the goal to really redirect wealth into places like Cambodia?
Very good question. I think what's nice is this cannot be purely commercial, so we do need what we call sort of a blended finance. And then in terms of the money returning back to the Cambodian people, we do see that that does happen, because what's happening now is, one, the people who didn't have electricity, they are getting it. Number two, we do see the fact that the productivity goes up. And then three, we see the investors who are getting the return actually reinvest in the communities. So I guess rightly it's called sort of the social capital market. So it is social and it is about sort of doing good and using finance to do good, which is really nice. For once, we are kind of seeing what finance should be doing, you know, working very holistically.
Are you worried that if interest rates start to pop up, that the kinds of returns that you'll be able to get will not look as attractive? I mean, if you can get 25% out, you are gold standard in these times of 3% interest rates or 1% or even negative interest rates. If that should change, is it a perilous moment?
I don't think so, because the return that you're getting, it's a financial return and a social return as well. So we really try to push both. So I'm not worried. I mean, we have been doing it for 7 years now. And, you know, people don't quib about, oh, you know, I should have gotten a percentage more or less. People do see this as a dual return. And now more and more the environmental angle is coming in as well.
You're insulated by the aspirations of people who want to
exactly.
have a better life.
Exactly. And this is an amazing opportunity for them, and they don't, you know, take it lightly.
Well, that is optimism, and I can definitely feel it. Doreen, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Doreen Shahnaz is the founder of the Impact Investment Exchange Asia. In Charleston, South Carolina today, a young man who seems to so many to be the embodiment of evil and the deadly consequences of hatred will defend himself in a courtroom. Convicted mass murderer Dylan Roof's sentencing trial has resumed after a judge ruled for a second time in a sealed hearing that Roof was competent to stand trial and can represent himself. Roof says he will not present any witnesses on his behalf. The jury has already begun hearing victim testimony from some of the more than 30 prosecution witnesses, including family and loved ones of the church members who died in the massacre that he was responsible for. Jennifer Berry Hawes is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the Post and Courier in Charleston and author of an upcoming book, Amazing Grace, about the Emmanuel AME church shooting. She has steadfastly been in this somber, unusual courtroom. Jennifer, how does it feel to be in there?
It's really bizarre most of the time. Roof sits there almost like a statue at his table, staring in front of him while the family members and earlier the survivors give these harrowing accounts of what happened and just really heartbreaking testimony about the loss of their loved ones. And to see him just sit there with no emotion at all, not looking at them, not seeming to really be paying much attention is just really surreal.
Have there been any attempts to interact with him by the defense or by some of these victims? I know the court has admonished people not to do so.
Really, not very much toward him. The judge will speak to him, of course, because he's acting as his own attorney, and the prosecutor will walk over and hand him photographs to object or not object to admitting into evidence. But otherwise, really the only interaction with him and in any of the families or survivors was when Felicia Sanders was testifying, and she said something to the effect of that, and that man over there who can't even look at me right now, said this to my son. And otherwise, he's almost like a non-presence in some ways, other than, of course, everybody's hyper aware of his presence, but he doesn't really speak, doesn't look at anybody, doesn't show any emotion. So he's representing himself, but in a way, it's almost as if the defense table is non-existent. It is, of course, but he rarely objects. He doesn't speak much. His opening statement was extremely short, kind of strange. So he's in some ways a non-entity. The prosecutors have really been able to present heartbreaking testimony while he sort of sits there and doesn't seem to care a whole lot.
Jennifer Berry Hawes is watchdog and public service reporter for the Post and Courier and author of the upcoming book Amazing Grace about the Emmanuel AME church shooting, where she is attending the trial of Dylan Roof. Jennifer Berry Hawes, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
We go now to John Bloom, Samuel F. Leibowitz Professor of Trial Techniques and Director of the Cornell Death Penalty Project at Cornell Law School. Professor Bloom, how much of the proceedings in South Carolina are, you know, just for this particular trial? Are the movement restrictions on Dylan Roof related to the fact that he's defending himself and some sense that things may go off the rails?
Well, it's unclear. There's not really necessarily a stated reason as for why. Normally, when someone is restricted like that, there's some expectation that they might, try and assault or attack a witness or someone or the judge or something. And as near as I can tell, there's been no indication of that. I mean, Roof is basically quiet, subdued, in many respects, almost non-existent at his own trial.
Is it possible that any of the rules, even something innocuous seeming as the movement restrictions on the defendant, might be grounds for an appeal?
I think it's certainly potentially possible. There would be questions of, has he objected to this and is it preserved? But I think the danger is, or a danger in this, is it could give the jury the perception, the even enhanced perception, that he is dangerous to them personally or to the witnesses under circumstances where, again, there's no evidence that I'm aware of that would suggest that that's true. So, you have this imbalance to begin with, that Roof is not presenting or doesn't intend to present a case in mitigation, which is something normally the jury would balance. And then you set that aside, the fact that he is basically his movement is being restricted. He's required to sort of sit if he's going to ask anyone anything. And so I think that could enhance the perception of dangerousness.
Although he did kill the people in the church. So, I mean, there is one data point that suggests danger.
But there's no indication that he is actually dangerous that he has any plan or to attack the jury or to attack a witness or to do anything of that nature.
The judge in this case seems to be very meticulously honoring the request by Dylan Roof that mental illness not be a factor in evaluating him in court testimony, depending. I guess we don't know what the jury is going to do.
Right. I mean, he has allowed Roof to represent himself, knowing that Roof doesn't intend to allow any evidence to be presented about his mental state or mental condition. And that's going to further complicate the jury's decision making.
Why do you think it's going to complicate it?
Well, because, I mean, normally when the Supreme Court put the death penalty back in business in 1976, it had a certain anticipation of how capital trials would work. The prosecution would present its case for death, why the defendant should be sentenced to death. The defense would present their case for life, what's called the case in mitigation, where they would present evidence about the defendant's life and background, any mental illness or mental impairments that they might have. And then the jury would make, you know, what's been called legally a reason, moral response, balancing the aggravation and mitigation and select the appropriate punishment. In this case, they're only going to hear one half of the equation, the government's case for death. Roof has been cleared that he doesn't intend to present anything in mitigation, and clearly he has blocked any evidence about mental impairments or mental illness.
Do you feel as though the jury might actually just have a simple choice here, though, if it goes the way it's been continuing, very quiet and sort of steady, that here's a young man who wants to be considered mentally healthy, he's ready to take his punishment, you know what I mean?
That assumes, of course, that he doesn't really have any mental illness or mental impairment.
Right.
And that so that he's making this sort of, you know, rational decision with a clean and sound mind, that he accepts the responsibility for what he did and is prepared to be sentenced to death and executed. The problem is, in some of this, we don't really know. I mean, there have been these closed hearings at which the evidence about his mental illness and mental impairment has been presented, so we don't really know what that evidence is. But we do know that there's some, and his lawyers wanted to present it, and that he has blocked it. So I think there's some reason to question the assumption that he is, you know, doing all this rationally, and that this isn't really the product of someone who, in fact, is quite disturbed.
Professor John Bloom, Samuel F. Leibowitz, Professor of Trial Techniques and Director of the Cornell Death Penalty Project at Cornell Law School. Thanks so much, Professor.
Yes, thanks for having me.
In an ideal world, change in healthcare policy should not involve scaring people worried that they will be left without coverage.
The first order of business is to keep our promise to repeal Obamacare and replace it with the kind of healthcare reform that'll lower the cost of health insurance without growing the size of government.
That's Vice President-elect Mike Pence, with Republicans repeating a promise that conservatives have made for years. Yesterday, President Obama spent the afternoon on Capitol Hill strategizing with Democrats on how to save the Affordable Care Act, now that Republicans are in a position to make good on what to many people has felt like a threat. But what will that health care look like, and who will it cover? The incoming administration has indicated that no one who is currently covered will lose their insurance. The president-elect apparently wants to maintain the parts of the law that make it illegal to deny coverage to people with pre-existing conditions. They also support allowing younger people to stay on their parents' insurance until they are 26, although Republican lawmakers haven't made similar promises. And for the 20 million people who went from nothing to coverage under Obamacare, there are fresh memories of the way things used to be and understandable fears about going back.
I owe the Affordable Care Act my life, because even though I have this pre-existing condition, I would be dead without the insurance that I have, to be honest with you.
That's Jacob Atkins. He's 31 years old from Indianapolis. Atkins was diagnosed with HIV last May when he did not have health insurance. And it's how he met Megan McCarthy, a care coordinator from a local nonprofit, the Damien Center, who helped him get insurance through the exchange. They both say they're worried there may be some more tricky navigating to do to maintain a health care safety net.
I did not have insurance, and I went to the Damien Center, where they hooked me up with Megan. She's my case manager, and so she helped me get plugged in and figure out how to navigate the process of the Affordable Care Act and getting insurance.
And the Damien Center is a nonprofit, Megan, that you got connected with somehow and became a care coordinator, and you're one of the many, many navigators around the country that help people like Jacob get through all the paperwork and find the coverage they need, right?
Yes, that's exactly right. It's pretty hard to navigate on your own, so that's where I step in and I can help out as much as I can.
And Jacob, now that they're talking about repealing the Affordable Care Act, I mean, I suspect you're going to need some navigation to get to the future, right?
Well, for sure. So from the beginning, I tried to, you know, get health care on my own, and I just kept kind of hitting know, dead end after dead end. And so I then turned to the Damien Center and was like, look, I need help. I had no idea where to go. I had no idea who to talk to.
And what kinds of health issues were you dealing with?
I was HIV positive, and I was also dealing with some mental health issues that I have been struggling with my whole life.
All right, so Megan and Jacob, I'm going to ask you to put on a slightly different hat now for a moment, since, yes, you're advocates of the ACA. You don't want to see it go anywhere, and that's a perfectly legitimate position to take. But you're also consumers now. Certainly in your case, Jacob, you are a client, a consumer, an American citizen who's getting this service. Critique the Affordable Care Act, if you would. Are there problems with it that actually do need some tweaking? How would you describe it in actual practice, Megan?
It's expensive. Another thing is, of course, like these, you know, marketplace plans only cover 80% of medication costs or lab draws or any other medical issues that are going on. And so then clients, you know, would be expected to pay that other 20%. But because of a great resource here in Indiana, the Indiana State Department of Health actually has another program that swoops in and pays that other 20%. So again, immensely invaluable. And if that ever goes away, I'm going to be lost. Clients are going to be lost. Patients are going to be lost. And again, very frustrating.
I agree. And personally, I get a little emotional, so I'm trying to, like, you know, contain my emotions. But as far as myself is concerned, I don't pay for my health insurance right now because I'm very lucky and very blessed that I found the Damien Center. They've helped me kind of navigate those premiums and navigate, like, the, you know, best things to kind of, like, apply for and go for. I can speak for my mother and my father, who are working class. They make, you know, under $40,000 a year, and they do the best they can with what they have. And their premiums are ridiculous. And they will go without seeing the doctor because they can't afford those premiums every month, even though they do have insurance through the marketplace and, you know, through the Affordable Care Act. It still is very expensive for them.
It's above their budget. Yeah. Okay, well, I guess what I'm wondering from your perspective, what kind of a message would you love to receive from either the president-elect or from Speaker Ryan or some member of Congress that would be reassuring that, you know, we're going to make some changes, but we're going to get to some end point that we can all live with?
I would be quite terrified if they just repealed without any sort of plan in place. And just, you know, from all the different interviews and things that President-elect has given to us, his plan of action has always been very hazy. He doesn't necessarily right now seem to have that plan in action. And so I guess before it's repealed, just making that plan very transparent would be, I guess, a little bit mind appeasing.
So, Jacob, if Megan is feeling like there's no plan here, how are you feeling?
I'm terrified, and, like, yeah, it scares me. It does. This is my safety net right now, and this is my $4,000 a month medications are taken care of right now. You know, so it feels very personal because, to me, this is my everyday life, and this is my health, and this is the energy that I give to other people and the energy that I give to my friends and my family, and yeah, it very much feels like a personal attack towards, you know, my integrity and my health and who I am. And because we don't know, like, there is that overlying, like, cloud of just, like, well, what's going to happen? You know, like I have to plan my life and my medications and, you know, my healthcare. I have to plan everything out in the future so that I know and my body knows, like, exactly, like, when things are going to happen. What's, you know, like, that's crucial in my healthcare and in my everyday life. And so with the unforeseen future of what public health is, it can be crippling if you don't, you know, stay positive and if you don't, like, look at people like I have Megan and I, along with a lot of other people, would be very lost.
All right. Well, let's stay in touch and see if we can't get through this challenging period. You know, Congress is getting down to business and we have to pay attention, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes,
for
we
sure
do.
We do.
Yes. I will encourage anybody that has the Affordable Care Act to, you know, this is our lives. This is our personal lives. And so you've got to turn to the people that you voted into office. And, you know, you got to write letters. You have to, like, call people, you know, do everything that you can. You know, this is your life. This is our life. And we have to protect each other. And, you know, even though not everything, you know, turns out like we want it to, like, we have to seriously come together as a community and stand for each other and for ourselves.
Jacob Atkins is HIV positive and gets his insurance through the Affordable Care Act. Megan McCarthy is Jacob's care coordinator at the Damien Center in Indianapolis. We plan to check in again with Jacob in a couple of months after we know what changes will be made to the ACA. Before we leave you today, we want to take a moment to remember Vidal Guzman. Vidal was a senior manager at Public Radio International, the network that co-owns and distributes The Takeaway. If you've been in this business long enough, you probably knew Vidal. He worked tirelessly doing what he loved, finding audiences for the programs he cherished. He dedicated 22 years of his life to PRI, responsible for sales, marketing, audience research, and fundraising, among so many other things, for shows like ours and The World, a show he helped to launch. Elisa Miller, CEO and president of PRI, said of Vidal, "He was a kind, funny, enthusiastic proponent of all that public radio is and could be, and so treasured by the whole public radio system." Vidal was a father of four and was vacationing with his family in Puerto Rico. He died after saving his 19-year-old son from drowning. A hero through and through, all our prayers and condolences to Vidal and his family. Thank you, Vidal, for all you did for The Takeaway and for the entire public radio system. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.